We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leese, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
How are you?
I'm fabulous.
Went into a deep freeze for a few days, and now it's like defrosting and refreezing?
I think it's going to be that way for the rest of winter for Cleveland.
It's weird. I'm wondering what the trees and flowers think of all of this.
I think they're confused.
Everything in my house is blooming. Everything. My begonias are blooming. My Christmas cactus blooms for months, but everything. I've got two Gerber daisies that I brought inside. Both of them have big daisies on them. It's just really bizarre.
I think what happened was the aliens came down. They put us to sleep for 2 months and woke us back up 2 months later, and the plants didn't get the message.
I guess not.
Does that make sense?
No.
Okay.
Okay, fine. So I want to follow up from last week's show when you asked if someone who might be from a culture where spicy foods are a staple of their diet.
I remember that.
Right. Would there be a difference in how much or how often someone might experience cramping?
Right.
So we asked Dr. Murray that question offline after we'd already finished our interview, and I want to let our listeners know what his reply was, right?
Right.
Okay. Quote, "We don't yet know how ethnicity or frequency of spice usage or tolerance to spice influences the reliability of the response. What we've seen so far is that there is likely to be far more variation among people than there will be among cultures. We also think that because the product is used before exercise or at the time of a cramp, that relatively infrequent usage pattern will not mute the benefits. Of course, we need to learn more about all of this from future research."
Well, I'll volunteer if they need somebody who doesn't like spicy stuff.
Yeah, me neither. I like it, but it doesn't like me a lot.
Well, I'm okay with it. Again, the Irish background, you know, boiled potatoes and cabbage and corned beef is about as spicy as it's going to get. So, but I think, you know, that's an interesting study, and I'd like to see that, you know, when they're done with it.
A lot of comment on the show last week about that. Yeah, it was a good show. It really came out well. I liked it.
It was very good.
Yeah. Okay. So you do a lot of reading, yeah?
I do some.
Yeah. I love good writing. I love to read good writing. And it seems that the bicycle world is really fortunate. We have a lot of good journalists and writers. People like Patrick Brady and Ian Dilley and Kaylee Fritz.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you saw this week. When we interviewed Kaylee a few weeks ago, we only talked about the Peloton, remember, and terrorism and all of that.
Right.
This week, Kaylee wrote a different kind of piece for Velo News. It's about a just retired pro by the name of Lucas, and I think I'll pronounce his last name correctly, User, E-U-S-E-R. The piece, which is titled "Finding Lucas User," is eloquent, it's compelling. The photography, and Kaylee did all the photographs too, is beautiful. It's all black and white. It was just such a pleasure to read. It's really good. So if you like good writing, if you want a fascinating story about cycling and cyclists, look up Finding Lucas User at VeloNews.com. It does make you pause and think. I'm not going to tell you what it's all about and why he retired and all of that, because that's all part of the story, which is really, really good.
I'll have to make sure that I put down the Twitters and the books and the chats and the snaps and the scopes and actually read something more than a few characters.
Okay. Should we move on to the show?
Yes.
Because we have a really cool guest this week. Probably one of the most interesting cycling luminaries I've never met in person. I've never met him. And by the end of our conversation, I think he and I are going to be good friends.
I think so.
Dave Toll. And by the way, it is not pronounced towel. And we'll have that conversation, I'm sure, is the voice of many cycling events. While we've spoken with the likes of Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin and even Bob Roll, Mr. Bob Key himself, we are about to be introduced to one of the most popular race announcers working in the sport today. Since I don't know a lot about him, and I didn't know a lot about him, and evidently he doesn't make a big deal about who he is and what he's done, I went to my sources and asked for some interesting background about him. And the one who spoke up, Eldon. Mr. Fat Cyclist himself, because he knows Dave. And here's what he said. Dave has a remarkable memory. Once you tell him something, he remembers it. And the guy is a listener. If you talk with him when he's off mic, he laser focuses right on you. I thought that was interesting. He said Dave is very funny. Dave has a huge heart. And his voice never seems to weaken.
Sounds like a great guy for a race announcer.
Exactly. So all of that's well and good, but it's what he knows about the sport and the riders and the way things work that I think is going to blow you away. So my interview with Dave takes up most of the show. After the interview, we will have time for some news and we'll wrap the show up and sort of let you know what's going on next week. But I don't want to waste any time. Let's welcome Dave Toll to the Outspoken Cyclist. Dave, thanks for joining me this afternoon. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, my pleasure.
So while I don't really know a whole lot about you, a lot of other people do, and I have learned some things, but I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your background. I know that you were born and raised in Colorado.
Yeah. Well, you know, to be fair, I wasn't born here. We moved here when I was pretty young, though. My dad worked for the United States Geological Survey. He's a geophysicist, and so he got a job. They were located in Golden, and so we moved out here, I guess it was 74, and so I would have been 7, 8 years old, and I actually remember, you know, we lived in West Lafayette, Indiana, and those kind of my first memories are from there. We were really lucky that a couple of years, my dad was on sabbatical, and we lived in Oslo, Norway, which I bet you didn't know.
No, that's cool.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't come up that much. But I was only, you know, 6 years old at that point. But yeah, we bounced around a lot. But we were lucky that it was all one of the cool things about academia is that usually college towns are pretty hip places. So
that's true.
Kind of lucky that way. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about before the cycling background. What else were you involved in, or what other things interested you besides cycling?
Well, I mean, I had a really normal childhood. I grew up in Boulder, I guess as normal as Boulder could be. That was one of the things I always remember, is it was made pretty clear to us when we were growing up that this is not the rest of the world is not like this. I remember my dad talking about, and you know, there was a definite lack of diversity here. I mean, the downside of growing up in such a beautiful place as Boulder. But I mean, up until through the normal childhood years, we did the same kind of stuff as any. But we were really lucky that the where I lived in South Boulder was right up against the Greenbelt, where they limit you weren't allowed to build any further up into the mountains. So we had access to the Front Range of Colorado like nobody's business, for sure. We did a lot of hiking and just kind of nature stuff. But the neighborhood I grew up in was also the neighborhood where the Coors Classic was organized out of, a guy named Mike Eisner.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you knew him.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. We all the kids in the neighborhood that I grew up in knew Mike and Kay and everybody who worked at the race office. They were very social people. And, I mean, by the time I was going to say 12, but that's sixth grade. More like by the time you were in the eighth or ninth grade, most kids would find some kind of role working at the race office. And I was really lucky in that it's all about timing. I love that book, Outliers. It really speaks to it. You know, you can have the motivation and the interest, but without the opportunity, everything doesn't always work out for you. So I was really lucky that you know, the epicenter of North American bike racing happened to be a block away from where I grew up. And, you know, as kids, everybody in Boulder at that point, you're talking late 70s, was aware of the event. It was something that people were stoked about. You know, it was kind of a rite of passage. Every summer, the circus coming to town comes to mind, except for it was much cooler. As far as, you know, the riders would come a couple of weeks before the race to acclimatize. It was really international at that point, much more than driven by professional sponsors. It was the Colombians and the Russians and the East Germans and the Irish and that kind of thing would all come. And every kid would kind of get assigned to be a gopher for one team or another. And that experience was priceless, just being around world-class athletes and especially at that time. Everything was kind of different.
I
was 16 driving the Soviet team around with, you know, the 1980 Moscow Games, which we boycotted.
Right.
They cleaned up. I mean, a guy named Sergei Sukhruchenkov won the gold medal in the road race. They won the bronze in the road race with a guy named Baranov. And then the entire team time trial team was there, too. So these were the cream of the crop of the you know, the Eastern Bloc's cyclists and who were considered really the best in the world.
What kind of bikes were they riding? Do you remember?
They were on Kolnagos.
Okay.
They rode Kolnagos most of the Soviet cycling era. It's almost entirely Kolnagos. And then at the end, when things got kind of weird, there was some Rossines and some Mazis that got kind of thrown in the mix. But the classic bike would be a red Kolnago Master.
And what was your favorite bike? A red Kolnago
Master. Exactly.
Did you get one?
No, never did. Couldn't afford it. Like, that was sort of and that was okay. It was much, much better to want and not get at that point in my life than to get things easily.
That's
made
true.
For sure. There's no doubt. The worst thing you could have done would have been in at 10th grade, given me a Kolnago Master with Super Record stuff on it. I wouldn't have appreciated it as much as I would.
Today.
You know, now. Right.
So, all right, you were sort of,
I bet you on eBay.
You were a course gopher. And then where did it go from there? You got into race announcing, and that's what you are known for, is this race announcing. How did you get into that?
Well, I worked in the bike industry. So all the way through that time, I worked in a bike shop here in Boulder called, the High Wheeler was kind of another sort of, now U-Bikes is the king of all things bicycles here in Boulder.
What's it called?
University Bicycles.
Oh, Everyone University here. Bikes. Okay. Yeah.
That's a guy named Doug Emerson, who also just built our velodrome, the Boulder Valley Velodrome. He and a guy named Frank Banta privately funded that, you know, multi-million dollar project. They talked for years. In Boulder, there were probably five different groups that, you know, Build Boulder, Velodrome Foundation, and all of these kind of things that, you know, city council meetings and fundraisers, but they never got anywhere where Doug finally just said, I'm going to buy the land and build it myself, and he did. But I worked in bike shops, and then I worked in the bike industry. I worked for Raleigh up in Seattle for a long time, and Shimano, and I was a mechanic, and then did some team mechanic work, and that was when the opportunity really. That story is really. They always say luck is when preparation meets opportunity, right? And that wasn't really the case for me. It was more in 2003. An incredible desire and being unwilling to take no for an answer, because there was a lot of no when I first started. But what it was just being all in on and willing to, it's really a complex thing to describe, Diane, but it's like that book, The Alchemist. I don't know if you've read that.
Oh, yes,
but
I have indeed.
Yeah, okay, so one of the things I really took away from that book was if you really, really want something, and the world will conspire to make that happen for you.
Right.
But it's only when you are completely committed and 100% all in on it that happens. people can tell when you don't have a complete commitment, or even whether they can tell or not isn't the issue. The world somehow knows that whatever those forces at play that are beyond me. I was working for this Saturn, who had a cycling team for a long time. They were a tremendous supporter. And at the end of their run, they had hired Michael Lasner, actually. And he was a consultant for Saturn on how to connect their cycling team and make it more viable as a marketing tool and give some relevancy to that program, which was a multi-million-dollar program, you know, employing, you know, more than 30, probably 40 people between riders and staff. And, you know, having that program keeping going was really important for cycling and a lot of people. So Michael got involved, and one of the things that he proposed and that they did was this kind of bike race in a box that was called Saturn Cyberbike. I remember the day we made up that name, actually. And it was CompuTrainers, which most people are aware of.
Right.
Just regular four CompuTrainers kind of hooked together with the giant plasma screen and a little dais and a stage kind of thing. And people who were going to the auto show to look at the new Saturn cars. And there's auto shows. That whole world was mind-blowing to me. I'm not a car guy at all.
We've got one coming up next month here.
Auto
show? Oh, yeah. It's a big, stupid deal.
And I totally agree. I hate to, you know, I really appreciate sponsors in cycling. But for me personally, going to the Milwaukee Auto Show and then the Cleveland Auto Show,
right.
Some of them are 9 days long. I remember the Minneapolis one was insane. I mean, it was like I think we flew there on Christmas Day, you know what I mean, to start the auto show the day after Christmas, to run through New Year's. And not that I, you know, missing those holidays is nothing to me. I'm 50, you know, I can miss a New Year's. That's no big deal. But just the grind of, 9 days hotel to the convention center. If you had wanted to, you never had to go outside. You could walk in the crazy tunnels that they have
right.
all the way from the hotel to the thing and back. And it was not good mentally or physically, anything for me. But it was good money, and I definitely needed it. So
you were announcing cyber in a box. How cool
is that?
I left
that humiliating part out. But yes, and it was really, I mean, I'm not kidding. You know, 9:15 at night in Milwaukee, it's snowing outside. It's a Tuesday night. There's nobody in the convention center except for the 2 8-year-olds that are racing for the 15th time on the Saturn Cyberbike while their mom is gone. And we're now babysitting them pretty much. And it's little Johnny digging in deep. It looks like he's about 200 meters in the line, but here comes Derek, and Derek is really burying it. Come on, Derek, you know, that kind of thing. And I could do it endlessly. I mean, it was just like so bizarre, the ability to just flip that switch and go into the last 300 meter call of, you know, and I'd never done it at a bike race, race.
It became who you are.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I'm talking with Dave. All right. I'm going to get this right. Watch this. I'm talking with Dave Toll. How'd I do?
Pretty well. Thanks. I don't mind when people the number of times I'm at races and people are like, hey, hell yeah, it's Dave Toll. How you doing?
No, actually, I have to admit, heard it pronounced by somebody, and I think it was Eldon who pronounced it. So I did hear you announce. I watched the Vimeo of the Grand Donut.
Oh, well, Eldon must have sent that to
you. He did. Uh-huh. And I have to admit,
some of my best work.
It is. Well, just watching Rebecca Rush on that little tiny bike was enough to make you had to watch it. You know, she's hilarious. So
that was quite a little event. I didn't really know what to expect going into that. And I don't think anyone did. It turned into a pretty funny. Patrick Dempsey doesn't hurt.
No, it does not hurt at all to have a celeb like him there.
No. And he's the best, man. I mean, that guy, it's insane how down to earth cool he is when you look at what's going on around him nonstop.
Isn't he the one whose mom either passed away or is sick with cancer?
Yeah.
And so he's involved in the Amgen, right?
Exactly. And right. he has the Dempsey Center for Hope and Healing right. up in Lewiston, Auburn, Maine, and built in her honor. His sister runs it. And it's a really, really cool cancer treatment center. And they're really underserved community in rural Maine there. And he stepped up and he really gives, he really cares about the place he came from. And yeah, just a really solid dude.
Is there a race that you've never been able to announce that you want to announce? Is there something you absolutely, it's like eating away at you?
Well, the really obvious answer would be the Tour de France.
Well,
right?
Of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's so obvious that I'll actually go with that.
Okay. How about the next one down really, the pike?
Well, you know, to be honest, doing the World Championship in Richmond this year was, that was, it's a really, really competitive job. So I felt like, and it worked out so incredibly well. Those were three of the best days I've ever had as far as connecting with the crowd that was just so genuinely enthusiastic. And whether you had the incredibly knowledgeable people there, or the people from Richmond that couldn't believe what they were seeing, it made for this great mix. And so I kind of felt like, through this last couple months and talking about it with friends, like, I don't really know that I can ever get to a higher level than that. It's Worlds. You know, it's Peter Sagan attacking right in front of you. It's like, it's unreal how I felt genuinely appreciative of the opportunity to be there doing that.
So it's the essence of the race. It's not the
sure.
name on the banner. That's pretty cool. That is really cool.
Yeah, I've never really, really thought about that. But, I mean, there's no doubt that being at Tour of California and, you know, with Brad Wiggins or something like that, and doing an interview with Brad Wiggins, it's genuinely something I appreciate. I'm lucky to be there. Whereas at an event that, you know, just the Haystack Criterium in wherever it may be, USA, I feel like I'm there really to do a job. And part of that is not taking it seriously without being serious. And that means, you know, always making sure that you're doing the podiums correctly and you're, you know, taking the time when a breakaway forms to figure out rather than just blowing it off and waiting for five laps to figure out if this is really going to settle in and be a breakaway. Because there's this element of work to announcing. The burning the calories of figuring out the eight riders in that breakaway, if they're just going to come back within a lap, that's
right.
a huge waste of brain power to go through all that to not really use it. But you get a feel for that kind of stuff. But the experience that the racer himself or herself is having, or and that's just, because I mean they're a huge part of that equation. They're listening, whether their race is coming up later or they're out there racing now. And I take it super seriously as far as always staying positive is on if someone's getting dropped or there's a split in the group or whatever. Never framing that, because they can hear that they're failing. It immediately in my mind becomes they've got an opportunity to get back in this. And I know that I've had a lot of racers through the years tell me that that was appreciated. Whether they were able to rejoin the group or whatever happened, they certainly appreciated not being called out as a failure in front of everybody there watching. And there's some announcers that I can understand, like if you really, really, really want to look at it, it is biased that way in that, you know, if you're calling a boxing match or a basketball game and a guy screws up, they're more than happy to highlight that screw up and show you a replay of that screw up. And
300 times.
300 times, right? They imagine, you know, dropping a touchdown pass in the end zone in
right.
a playoff game in the NFL. And then they'll criticize that he should have caught that. And I get that. And that's okay. I'm not against that. But I don't think that the thing is, the players can't hear that.
Wow.
You know, like,
I never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, they're not hearing Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin on the TV in real time.
No.
But if you're racing a Criterium in the U.S.,
they're hearing you.
when, you know, if there's a Doppler effect and they can't hear everything, and I get it. And, you know, some riders are more in tune to listening to find out what gaps are, who's in the break, that kind of thing. But yeah.
I'm just surprised to understand that announcing from a different perspective, it's so obvious that you love it. That's what's so cool.
Well, thanks, Diane. The flip side of that is you can make mistakes, even though you're not the official. You're the one person that can screw it all up more than any, or as much as an official could.
Wow.
If they're really off their game. But, and you know, you announce 1,000 criteriums in the United States, and you do races from 8 o'clock in the morning with the Cat 5 men all the way to the pros at the end of the day.
Right.
You're going to have that moment where, well, and it, you know, it depends on who's flipping the lap cards and how much attention everybody has been paying. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about taking it seriously without being serious. Well, that means that, you know, once you get inside of 5 laps to go, you'd better lock it down in your mind what you're doing as an announcer. And then, you know, when they're showing 2 to go with 1 to go, you yourself know in your heart of hearts and you just know that it's really 1 to go. And then in that, there's a 15-second window where you look at the official and you're like, I'm telling you, it's 1 to go. And if you have a track record with them of being on point, and, you know, they'll just flip it to 1 and assume that you're right and then let the chips fall where they may.
Huh,
right?
Interesting.
But you get that one wrong once and it changes everything.
Sure.
And yeah, you ring the bell at 2 to go when it's 1 to go and watch how that plays out.
Yeah, right, exactly. I don't think that the general public understands bike racing. And to hear somebody who has such an inherent knowledge and breadth of knowledge of how a race works is just fascinating. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Dave Toll. And I can tell you, huge respect here for the work, because
well, I
am not a bike, a race announcer. I love watching it. And I'm understanding a lot more about it just from hearing what you have to say. So I'm going to lighten it up just a little bit and ask you, you mentioned something on your Facebook page. So can more people pronounce Toll or Knopfler?
Yeah, well, I never really, unfortunately, never really got to the bottom of that. I'm going to guess that Knopfler carries enough clout, you know, like,
yeah, maybe.
I wonder, I mean, if you ask people like who was in the Dire Straits, how many people would know these days?
That's
I mean,
true.
To be honest, and going what you were saying earlier, like, I assume that people will get it wrong. It's okay. It honestly is. I'm not saying that in a like, oh, but he really does get upset. I really don't.
The point?
Well, exactly.
What's the point? It's like there's bigger things in life than getting your name wrong,
well,
right?
And that's another one too. Like I take, I remember once when I was doing a World Cup mountain bike race, and they're like, "Hey, be prepared, man. Make sure that you have every national anthem, no matter who wins. You know, make sure you've got the national anthem for that country on ready to go." And I was like, oh, yeah, no problem. And I looked into it. I was like, well, good. You know, there's no racer from the Cook Islands who's going to be contesting a World Cup mountain bike race. But I was like, I'm going to get every national anthem and just have it so I can never get caught out, you know, no matter what country they want. And so the same thing happens with last names. But then you realize there's this, you can't always, no matter how prepared you are, there's things that are outside of your control. So, you know, all of the things like Polish last names that start with a Z and realizing that that's a soft Z, or, you know, just kind of understanding it, like it's the joy of words but with names where
right.
You realize like, well, this is sort of how this usually works. And, you know, not every Slovakian name that ends in IK, it could be Ick, it could be Itch. You don't, you know,
right.
Ivan Stevic or Ivan Stevic. You know, you'd have to ask Ivan, really, to get an answer to that. So we went through, I guess, case in point, I take it seriously to get people's last names correct. Even if you're a 13-year-old who's finishing 3rd in whatever race, I still want to get it right. You deserve that. I don't care where you're finishing. It doesn't matter. We went through this thing where, so I'm just going to tell you, that Jens, everybody loves Jens, the most popular rider that I've seen really through my time, just True. Connects with people in an amazing way. The whole shut up legs thing is a phenomenon. But Jens's last name, and it's partly on Phil Liggett, to tell you the truth, but Phil Liggett says on whether it was Outdoor Life Network or NBC Sports, has always called him Jens Voigt. Like Voigt, the sporting
goods
company.
Like John Voigt, yeah. Okay.
Right, like John Voigt.
Okay.
Right. And so, but it's Jens Voigt is how
no
he
kidding.
Said.
No kidding.
And I knew some people in growing up in Boulder. They're still around, the Voigt family, and they spell it like Jens. And, you know, 15 years ago at a local bike race, Mr. Voigt came up to me when I was saying Voigt and said, in the perfect way, this is absolutely how you handle it. Instead of being blustered up and snot bubbles coming out of your nose because you're so upset that the announcer's getting the name wrong, you walk up nicely and you say, hey, my daughter is racing and really appreciate you announcing today. And just wanted to give you a heads up that her last name is actually Voigt. And I know it's spelled Voigt and people say it Voigt all the time, but if you got it right for us, we would really, really appreciate that. And I said, yes, sir. And from then on, it was Jessica Voigt, right? And that made the Voigt family happy, and it made me happy.
That's hilarious. You know? That's a great story. That's awesome.
Well, good. I'm glad you like it.
No, I love it. Hey, Dave, we need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You are listening to my interview with Dave Toll on The Outspoken Cyclist.
The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm talking with race announcer and really cool guy, Dave Toll. Hey, Dave, what did you think about that crazy video with Peter Sagan and his wife?
That guy, the Grease remake. That's impressive.
You're the one I want, right?
I have a feeling that that was more Katharina's idea than Peter's. I have a feeling that was something that she must have really wanted to do.
But he didn't?
Oh, no, good for him. She's cool, too. She's come to the Tour of California and was super – one of the best stories that they haven't told about Peter winning Worlds was Peter is one down-to-earth guy. He grew up certainly not wealthy and has really what you'd love to see every star in sport do, go from that and then become just such a graceful human being as a champion. And so Peter had every opportunity to stay at Richmond Worlds. There were two main hotels that were right at the start line where like one entire floor would be the Dutch contingent, another floor would be the Belgian contingent, but the Slovaks don't have the resources or the federation or anything to do that.
Weren't there only two Slovak racers?
Right.
Okay.
So they stayed at a Holiday Inn Express, which actually wasn't that bad. You know, I mean, they're fine. They're great, actually. To tell you the truth, I mean, when you roll the dice, when you're out on the road 150 days a year, Holiday Inn Express falls way above the Mason-Dixon line on the what you could get.
Well, it's
for
predictable. You know what you're going to get.
Exactly. It's clean. And that's really probably the most important thing of all,
yep.
I think, is cleanliness. So he decides rather than get a room down with everybody else downtown, this hotel's a good 6 miles, not convenient, out by the airport, but that's where the mechanics and the whole everybody else. Now they had two pro men, but they also had, you know, some juniors and U-23s and that kind of thing. So they had a contingent there. And So it's not, you know, I'm not like, oh my God, what a guy that Peter stayed out there at that Holiday Inn Express. That's cool. That's, you know, not out of the norm of what a human being would do. But what I found to be fascinating is the fact that not only after he won, well, the morning that he won, he ate the Holiday Inn breakfast, you know, the free breakfast.
Yeah,
that
sure.
We all have, the sausage patties and the odd egg, whatever that egg thing is, and, you know, the little yogurt cups and, you know, the kind of thing that your average American businessman looks at as a pretty low-grade breakfast, I think, you know. And that's what Peter had for breakfast the morning that he won the almost 250K of racing.
Yeah,
that day.
Yeah, that was a brutal race. Jeez.
Oh, it was unbelievably hard. And yeah, and then you hear the stories of, you know, what Peter did that night. And it's hanging out with his brother and some friends from Slovakia that, you know, just cool.
We have a word for that. Yeah. In Yiddish, we have a word for that. It's mensch, M-E-N-S-C-H.
Uh-huh.
A real man. He's just a real guy.
Yeah, that applies perfectly. It really does.
Right, right.
And man, did this sport need that?
Yeah, no kidding.
This is the guy. You hate to heap all of the – well, it doesn't matter. All that pressure's been on him all along. You can't put any more pressure. This guy works for Oleg Tinkoff.
Right, that's true.
He knows all about the games that people play and the manipulation and the people are going to be vying for his time and attention and all that stuff. And Peter is almost transcending that in his – he just doesn't really care. You know, I think he's making enough money and he's able to look after himself and his friends in a way that he's not going to – he's going to have some fun with this thing, but he's not going to let it consume him. And I think that, you know, the sport needs that smiling face. And you remember how much flack he took for the pinching of the podium girls?
Yes, I do. Of course I do.
You know, let's look back on that, right? It's like, it goes back to what you're saying a little bit earlier about this, the microaggression in society where something that really doesn't make any difference and 20 or 30 years ago would have been forgotten about by the next day. But there's these people out here and the internet gives them a platform to be outraged about this.
Yeah, I call it a slow news day.
Yeah, I would
it's
agree.
Like, don't you have something better to do, really?
Well, a slow news day combined with the fact that there's a lot of people out there that are just pissed off
about everything,
about right. everything.
Right.
And you know what, if they can in some way help pile on and try to wreck somebody's day, they're more than happy to do that.
Isn't
it's a
that
hobby.
Sad?
Yeah, it is sad.
It's just
sad. I think we bottomed out on that though, Diane. I'm starting to feel more in society, like now with Twitter and that kind of thing. If you're that kind of troll person who's got an egg next to your made up name
yep.
that doesn't make, and you're afraid to show any kind of a picture of yourself or give any kind of accountability to who you are or this person that makes these brazen, hurtful statements about subjects that you don't even have any connection to.
You're going to get called out.
I think so. I think that kind of person has become ugly. Well, they always were ugly.
I was just going to say they were always ugly.
No, and they definitely were. But I think they kind of had a period of time where they were given a little more platform than they deserved. And now people are more likely to look at that kind of thing and just say, that's just a jerk.
Right, exactly.
Move on.
We're going to take a left turn. I want to remind our listeners, once again, we're speaking with Dave Toll. And I want to ask you about looking into a crystal ball, whether you have it or not. Tell me what you think is going to look, the sport's going to look like going forward in 2016, not just at the elite mm-hmm. level, but in general. You know, we've talked mm-hmm. about doping for years. I don't really want to talk about it, but I want to know where you think the sport is going. You seem to have such a unique perspective.
Well, once again, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate what you're doing with the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So it's funny. I was just this morning over at the bank, and I ran into Chris Baldwin, who's a former pro for Toyota United and Bissell, and just a really journeyman, great guy, really, really awesome example of what cycling can do for a person. And another guy named Clark Sheehan, who runs the Orange Guy Fence Company. They do all the fencing at the major events. And it was just kind of ironic to see those two together. And we talked about exactly what you're asking me, because, and these are two guys that both make their living in the sport. Chris is now coaching Rob Britton and is a, you know, he's a influential guy in the sport, and so is Clark with his business and his history. And all three of us were sitting there just going like, what do you know? Well, what's going on? And your question was kind of twofold, and I appreciate that, because I think the second part is more relevant. But in as far as pro cycling and the Tour de France dropping out of the World Tour for 17, and the CPA, the Riders Union, that is starting to kind of make some noise again, and it looks like they maybe we're going to start taking them seriously as they start taking their themselves seriously. It is really, really hard to say what's going to happen. I really, really like a rider named Rowan Dennis, and he just yesterday won the Australian time trial championship.
He did indeed.
And he had a comment a couple weeks ago, and I thought it was really profound. And just to make you think for a second, it, you know, the Tour de France has really always been in July and holds that cornerstone date. What if, and you know, the Giro, the RCS, these guys are basically broke at this point. They're hurting.
Well, Wang is looking to buy them. You know, the Chinese guy.
He should. He'll get the Giro. He'll get the Giro and with RCS properties. I mean, which is like some of the most exciting events in the world.
Right.
Strade Bianca. I mean, it's crazy what they have. And you could get them probably at a bargain price right now. And imagine this. Imagine the Giro d'Italia moves to July as well. And that there's a riders union that's strong, like watertight, and holds up. And all the top riders in the world don't go to the Tour de France in 17 because they can't negotiate any kind of a deal that they're happy with, you know, I mean, really for the, it, everything, Diane, is about money at the end of the day. And there's only, the pie is only so big, and the Tour de France has really taken, I mean, they have controlled that pie and left a few other small slivers for other organizing groups and races out there. And it's been that way for a long time. This is nothing new. And it kind of worked before the UCI played the World Tour card so hard. And, you know, when the Tour de France had the autonomy to basically choose what teams were in the race for the most part, that worked a lot better for them, because it allows them more room to negotiate with sponsors and just all of that backroom stuff. That's not bad backroom stuff, but, you know, I mean, if you want to have your team in a major bike race and you have a team that's right on the bubble of whether you're, you know, whether you deserve to be in the race or not based on, you know, all of the different criteria, but the most important criteria should be athletic to the fan. Anyways,
right.
You want the best riders in the race. You don't care if they have the best sponsor or not.
Of course.
You know, you just want the best guys or women. And what's happening there then is if you're right on the bubble and you've got three different teams in one spot, well, the team that says, yeah, we'll activate in your expo area every day during the race as well, that would be the difference maker then, because now your team sponsor, and Saturn did it and Mercury did it in the United States, and you know, the sponsor of the team needs a place for their team to race, and they want that exposure. And if that means then that they have to participate by helping sponsor the race in a roundabout way, well, so be it. That's how business works. But if you don't have the top racers, you don't have anything. We've learned that with sport. Just look at the NFL strike. I think that's the perfect example of scab players. I've never been in a union or been a union person. I always thought that term scab seemed particularly harsh, but I guess it's a really serious, I don't guess, it is serious business when you've got thousands of people who aren't able to work or aren't working because they're on strike or whatever it is. But ultimately, the especially these days, the people watching bike racing are so savvy. They know what's up. They clearly know when they're watching the best in the world and when they aren't. So if Chris Froome and Alberto Contador and Quintana and Rowan Dennis and all those guys decide that they're going to race the Giro instead of the Tour de France, and the Giro moves to July, can you imagine? I mean, that's just a crazy, crazy world. And that scenario will never play out. But that's how wide open it is right now.
What about the American racing? I mean,
well, and then that's a much more pleasant thing to talk about, and actually something that maybe I would be, you know, I'm like a lot of people. Most of what I know, I read or, you know, I guess pick up in conversations with people. But I mean, I'm certainly not in tune with what Brian Cookson is doing today in Egel, Switzerland. That's for sure, or what the they're doing with the ASO. But with American racing, I tell you, I think it's going to be really interesting for USA Cycling. From almost every account, I haven't heard one person yet. I guess we're kind of at the end of the honeymoon period now. But DBA, or Derek Bouchard Hall, has been really well received.
Yes, he
is the new CEO. Yeah, I mean, when you look at where we were a year ago and where we are now and the initiatives that he's putting together and what he seems to be listening to all of the different factions in the cycling world, and I couldn't imagine anyone doing a better job. Not that the rival federation that is coming together is really the issue in my mind. It's more that it's become this question of insurance for so many organizers that I know. All the other parts that you need to put on a bike race, they can make happen one way or another without USA Cycling. But the insurance, and that's a big one. I mean, yeah, you know, if you're going to organize an event, that's got to be one of the most important things to you is, are we properly covered here? Because bike racing is crazy. Lots of things happen out there. And we live in a society that is pretty sue happy. Nowadays, you know, when you look at why would I, you know, want to organize my event under the umbrella of USA Cycling, that's probably the number one reason that most organizers have.
Right.
And as other options come along, you know, you're starting, well, I mean, there's no question that you're seeing a lot. I don't want to, well, you know what? I mean, it's not throwing people under the bus. There's a lot of great events right now that you don't need a USA Cycling license to race. And there's
more.
But
you do need insurance.
And those events have it. I mean, an example would be Dirty Kansas or any of these gravel races. These races are fun. The people organizing them are in it for all the right reason. I've never worked with a group. I've only been to Dirty Kansas once. That was last year. And I was so professional, but professional, that same serious, but take it seriously, but not serious. That's exactly what they're doing. They dot their I's and cross their T's, and everything's been thought through, and there's processes, and nothing is just happenstance. It all has a reason why everything is set up the way it is. And I just love that when the rider's experience is the registration goes smoothly and it starts on time and the course is well marked and you get accurate results at the finish. And instead of saying, and there'll be food at the finish, and then it's just cold hot dogs and a bag of chips, you know, they've got someone running a barbecue and, you know, like at Levi's Grand Fondo, they've got the people making paella and, you know, it's so cool to the from soup to nuts, as they say. That experience is great for the athlete. And I think that with a lot of the standard run of the mill races, and unless you do something to stand out and make yourself special, you're a dodo bird now.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because for many, many years, I was a ride director. I did a few races, and I always said, if your participants are happy, your sponsors will be happy. Because
amen.
Those are the people who are going to come back and do it again or not. Well, what I'd like to do is reserve the right to come back and talk again. Can we do that?
Hey, anytime.
So awesome. What a fabulous conversation. And I so appreciate you being so open and honest and just out there with me. It's great.
Well, thank you, Diane.
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
All right,
anytime.
Dave. We'll talk again.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Dave Toll joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. Well, Mr. Tim?
we don't have enough time to comment on half of the stuff that he talked about. It's just so, it's great to hear from him finally. And finally, we can put the Jens Voigt pronunciation to rest.
Yeah, well, that's true. But what a refreshing conversation, huh?
Yeah, we can talk to him all night long.
We're going to take a real quick break, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And before we get into some news for this week, I'd like to remind our listeners of a few things. Number one, our on-air broadcast, which has been at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, which means it also streams at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, is moving to 6 p.m. next week.
That's a better time slot for us.
I think it is a better time slot. It gives Mr. Madigan, Retro Radio, an extra half hour, and then after us will be a sports podcast by the guy who actually edits our show, Dale Armbruster, and his buddy. So, again, Outspoken Cyclist on WJCU 88.7 FM in Northeast Ohio will go to 6 p.m. on the 23rd. That's number one. Next month is Radiothon.
Already?
I know. It doesn't seem like it's been 12 months, right? It's been almost 12. Actually, it's been 11 months. So Radiothon is when we come to you once a year to raise some money to put new equipment in the studio. None of the money goes to the college. It all comes to the radio station. And we're in a pretty spiffy little studio here. And it all has come to us via past Radiothon. So I urge you to consider if you like the show and if you want to support the station, that will be your opportunity to do so. I think we will have two Saturdays that we'll be in the studio taking phone calls, and then there'll be an online ability to make your pledge. And there'll be some little trinkets you can get, like shirts and hats and that kind of stuff, depending on how much money. You know how it works. It's just like everybody else's, fundraiser, on-air fundraiser. And then here's my last little rant, and this is the sarcastic part, because I'm such a savvy social media maven, right? I'm the worst.
You're not the worst, but you're getting better.
Okay. I did not know how important it is that people rate podcasts on iTunes. It was brought to my attention, not only by Tim, but I think by my buddy, Mr. Fatty Cyclist. If you like The Outspoken Cyclist and you subscribe to the RSS feed on iTunes, now I do know what that means. I do know what an RSS feed is. Yeah, because we have one on the Outspoken Cyclist blog site, too. Please take a moment to just click the star of your choice. Now, don't click one. If you don't like us, let me know why. If you click four or five, I can smile a lot. And rate the show. You can also write a review, too. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
There are a few out there. Yeah.
And it helps if you subscribe also.
It does. It turns out that rating the show makes a difference where the podcast appears on the iTunes page. I didn't know that. So when you log on and being the fierce competitor that I am, which is more sarcasm, I'd love to see us on the front page. That would be fun, right?
That would be great.
Okay. So let's move on to the news. Go ahead. Talk to me about what you got first.
Women's Bike Mechanic Scholarship recipients announced.
Oh, good. That was the one that was part of QBP and a bunch of other people. Yes.
16 female bike mechanics received some good news this week, learning that they were recipients of the third annual Women's Bicycle Mechanic Scholarship, a program title sponsored by QBP, SRAM, RockShox, Park Tool, and the United Bicycle Institute, or the UBI.
Right.
The recipients will attend UBI's Professional Shop Repair and Operations Workshop in Ashland, Oregon, in late February and early March. This will be the first time that the two-week mechanics training program will have an entirely female class. The scholarship covers the winner's tuition and the lodging, so congratulations to the ladies. And there were 300 women that qualified, and they narrowed it all the way down to 16 of them. And it's a nice long list, and maybe we'll get to that next time. We'll list off the ladies' names, but none from Ohio, so maybe we can do a little bit about that.
I think it's really interesting that 300 women applied. That's awesome.
I think it's fabulous.
Who knew? So I also, one other thing that's coming up, which we didn't mention, we will mention because I'm going to be there, is the North American Handmade Bike Show next month.
In?
Sacramento.
Oh, you're leaving in February. You're going away from the miserable weather and...
For 3 days.
Okay.
All right. So it is the last weekend in February, but it doesn't hit the 29th. That's Monday. So it's the 26th, 27th, 28th. It is at the Sacramento Convention Center. Yes, I will be there. We will be talking, of course, as we always do, to the show owner, Don Walker, sometime in the next couple of weeks. I just want to remind people who are listening from the California area and surrounding areas, or even if you just want to fly in from wherever, it's always a wonderful show. You can look at the 2016 handmadeshow.com, and the exhibitor list is like ginormous this year. It's going to be fun. A lot of new builders. A lot of builders I don't know, and I'm excited about meeting them.
And you'll get to do an interview or two?
I actually have something very interesting that I'm working on, and I will be conducting a panel of frame builders talking about the business of frame building.
So people will get a chance to see you talk in person.
Yakety yak. Don't talk back.
Okay. Remember the day after Thanksgiving, what do we call
Black
that?
Friday?
Black Friday. Genesis Cycles in Easton, they decided to give their entire staff the day off.
That is correct.
Well, here's a little bit of a follow-up.
Okay.
How did things go? They asked the owner of the shop, which is Tobias Hinchcliffe.
Right.
And he said it went well. We made up the lost sales on the weekend. Employees donated about $1,100 to Safe Harbor, which is the charity they worked with.
Right.
And customers donated $200 in cash and a few hundred dollars worth of products that was on Safe Harbor's list of things they needed. And he'll talk to his staff about it, but his hope is that this is something they can continue year on, and it would really be a good thing, I think. So it's great that he didn't lose anything, and maybe he started a good tradition.
Yeah, it's a nice tradition. Letting your employees stay home on Black Friday is a nice tradition. I like that very much. So there's a new initiative from Adventure Cycling that was announced this week. Bike Your Park Day. It'll take place September 16th. Bring your friends and family and join the celebration of the National Park Service's centennial. National Park Service turns 100 this year. Adventure Cyclists' 40th, which is hard to believe, but that's true because it was in 1976. And National Public Lands Day. It's a free entrance day in some of the parks. We'll find out more about it later this summer. But so mark your calendar if you want, because we have a national park here. We have the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. And I think it'd be fun to be able to just kind of ride around the park and see a whole bunch of other cyclists.
I think there's a lot more. Each state has more national parks, I think, than people realize. So you're going to have more opportunity to ride in places that maybe you didn't think you could before.
Right.
Robotic cycle parking on the cards for the UK. EcoCycle, one company producing high-tech bike storage facilities, believe the UK is ready for automated bike parking. Automated robotic cycle parking could be on the cards for London, at least according to one company that provides the units.
I wonder if that's the same unit we reviewed maybe last year or even
EcoCycle supplies high-density underground bike parking to megacities like Tokyo in a video that we saw last year. And it was suggested such schemes could be in the future for UK cities like London, where street parking is very premium. In Tokyo, users pay $21 a month to use the parking garages. So the question is, will people be willing to pay for these, or who's going to build these and all the other things that go with it? But I think it's a great idea. And the other thing that it provides is security for your bike.
Right.
Locked away inside one of these, unless somebody's backing up with a semi stealing a whole bunch of them, your bike is a lot safer and secured than out on the street anywhere else.
The question for me is always, are you standing in the rain waiting for it to come back up from the underground? You know,
or can you
maybe
get
they have a shelter?
A double door, one for your laundry, one for your bike. Can we do the dry cleaner?
That's pretty good. So, you know, we talk about the women's Afghan cycling team and their courage as they defy the odds and continue to ride and race bicycles in a country whose traditions deny women even the most basic of rights, right? This year, the Afghan women are up for an Adventure of the Year award from National Geographic, and you can help them get that award. You can vote daily You log on to adventure.nationalgeographic.com/adventure, Adventurers of the Year. And just look for the Afghan women and vote every day. You can vote through January 31st. I hope they win.
That would be
They're
great.
They're courageous girls.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you have an opportunity, I also hope you get to go for a ride this week. Next week, we will be talking with two people who have been in the industry longer than me.
That's not that long, is it?
It is. One almost 60 years and the other probably 50 years. If you can figure it out, good for you. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.